Tonight you are going to hear some things that could frighten you. You may shake your head. You may not believe it. I only ask that you listen to tonight's program with an open mind. In a moment, Jim Marrs joins us. The Rise of the Fourth Reich on Coast to Coast AM. Jim Marrs, an award-winning journalist, has more than 30 years' experience with several Texas newspapers. In 1999, he began teaching a course on UFOs, perhaps one of the first university-level UFO courses in the country. Jim also investigated the Army's remote viewing program 3 years before it was publicly acknowledged by the CIA and produced The Alien Agenda, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, we are talking about now as well. He's written also Rule by Secrecy. Here he is tonight on Coast to Coast. Jim Marrs back. Hey, Jim, how are you?
George, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Likewise. This is an amazing book that you have written. They all have been, but this one...
It even amazed me.
...is chilling, Jim. It is chilling. And, you know, in addition, we'll talk about the Nazi bell, too, because that somehow ties into this. But the title here, The Rise of the Fourth Reich. Does that in German, does that mean kingdom? What does that mean?
Well, in German, with a capital R, it means empire.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really no question that America now is the preeminent world empire. But what's interesting, George, is that also in the German, when you use the word Reich with a small r, it means rich or wealthy. So I think you could argue that Reich, at least the way I'm seeing it, implies a empire of the wealthy.
Jim, what got you to write this book? Because, you know, you and I have talked about various aspects of your work over the years. This one's right on the money.
Well, I'll tell you something. You know, going all the way back to the late 60s and the hippies and the anti-war movement, you know, we always heard talk of America with a K, and that they're a bunch of Nixon and they were all a bunch of fascists and they're all a bunch of Nazis. And like everyone else, I kind of blew that off as just radical rhetoric. But as I began to research the rise of the Fourth Reich, I was absolutely chagrined to find out that some of the most prominent companies, some of the most prominent families in the United States were big supporters of Adolf Hitler and his Third Reich, his Third Empire. And they continued to support him through the war. As late as beginning of 1945, the war almost over, Standard Oil tankers were refueling Nazi U-boats in the Caribbean. Business apparently knows no political or geophysical boundaries.
You know, during this rise of the Third Reich, they were truly brilliant individuals. Let's not give them the credit for their inhumane treatment of people, but in terms of their knowledge of technology and their knowledge of manipulation, they were experts at that, Jim, weren't they?
That's absolutely correct, George. And here's the thing that I find the most horrifying about the Third Reich Nazis. Yes, people were killed. Yes, people were exterminated. Yes, people were just shot out of hand. In wartime, these atrocities happen on all sides. And you can always find some thug, some criminal you can hire to go kill anybody you tell him to. But the true horror to me of the Nazi Third Reich was the bureaucracy, the calm, conscious, cold-blooded methodology,
yes,
that was used. In other words, as far as anybody knows, you know, Adolf Hitler never personally killed anybody, but he allowed this system to come into existence where at the very top, for instance, at the Wannsee conference, they said, well, you know, we've got a problem with the Jews and we need to get them out of our society. And there were some very philosophical decisions made. And then it just trickled down through the bureaucrats and the second and tertiary officialdom. And then finally at the bottom, you know, people were bludgeoned in the head and shot against the wall and you know, thrown into gas chambers. It was really unconscionable. And of course, what at the end of the war, over here particularly and in the free countries, the true horror was is that the German people, who prior to World War II, had been among the most educated and cultured people in the world, and that they had allowed this national socialist system to come into power. And I want to point out that Nazi, N-A-Z-I, is simply an acronym for National Socialism.
And prior to this, weren't the Jews who were living in Germany a very integral part of their society in business and commerce, and they got along with everyone, and the Germans got along with them?
To a large extent, that's very true. In fact, back, for instance, maybe in the early 20s, some of the most prominent Jewish physicians and psychologists and scientists were Jewish, yes. And another thing to keep in mind is that the extermination programs that we are now so fully aware of really didn't actually begin until along about 1940, after the war had already begun.
How could, and let's assume we're blaming Hitler for creating the ideology for this, for the mass slaughters.
Well, you can, certainly can't say he was an innocent.
No, he wasn't. But I'm, how could one man create this ideology and get so many people to agree to do such horrible things? What happened to people and their judgment? What happened to people to say, no, I'm going to put my foot down, I'm not going to do this?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, and that actually gets to the heart of my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich. Hitler, as one man, as kind of a short little guy with a funny mustache, probably couldn't even have made it as a stand-up comedian.
He failed in everything except running his country, which he ultimately failed in that, too.
And the answer is he had powerful behind-the-scenes support. To extend all the way to occult societies.
He was truly a warped individual that then was able to get all these other people to simply follow him. You think the Pied Piper was good at what he did. Hitler, he had it down to a science, didn't he?
And it's absolutely amazing. I mean, at some point, all the Germans would have had to do is just say, no, we're not going to do that. And that would have been the end of it.
Yep. And there, you know, there were some who wanted to assassinate him, who wanted to do him in, who wanted to stop, but there weren't a lot. The people in power were able to continue to do what they were doing.
That's exactly right. And let me just quote from Hermann Goering, one of his top lieutenants. In fact, the man who I think ended up in charge of the Third Reich, which is days before it was all over with. And at Nuremberg, he said this. He said, well, of course the people don't want war. That's understood. But after all, it's the leaders of the country who determine the policy. And it's always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it's a democracy or a fascist dictatorship, parliament, communist dictatorship, voice or no voice. The people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. This is easy. All you have to do is tell them they're being attacked and then denounce the pacifist for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. Boy, doesn't that sound kind of familiar?
Yeah, it sure does. It sure does.
And, again, to show the tie-in, this sounds like exactly something that someone would accuse President George W. Bush of, telling us we've been attacked. And, of course, you can't see the wreckage, and you can't see the evidence because that's national security. And then here we go off to war and everything else. And then the clincher is that President Bush's grandfather, the powerful senator from Connecticut, Prescott Bush, was actually prosecuted in late 1942, halfway through World War II, under the Trading with the Enemies Act for being nothing but a financial front man for Hitler and the Nazis.
And his bank was almost shut down, or it was close to it, wasn't it?
It was shut down. Union Banking Corporation was handling the money for Fritz Thyssen, the German steel magnate, who, by his own admission, was the chief funder of Adolf Hitler. And Prescott Bush also sat on the board of directors of the Hamburg America Steamship Line, which later was identified as the key transportation for Nazi propaganda and funding and Nazi saboteurs that were coming into this country.
Of course, the sins of the grandfather don't necessarily equate to the sins of the grandson. However,
that's very true. We have to remember that when we consider that Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of your fine state, was a big fan of Hitler's early on. He made no secret about that, and his father was a Nazi party official.
True. Absolutely true.
But the acorn never falls too far from the tree.
That is the problem, James. That is the problem. Sometimes it falls too close.
It comes back to a worldview outlook. And what you'll find, and this is what's absolutely fascinating to me, and you have a lot of people who have studied history from various standpoints, and they never quite get it. The same people who created and funded Hitler and essentially created the Third Reich were the same families, the same banks, the same financial interest who created communism in Russia.
That's true.
But apparently, the communism in Russia, once it fell into the hands of Joseph Stalin, who was an absolute iron-handed dictator, they kind of lost control over that. And all of a sudden, the communists were talking about the international, that they were going to bring communism worldwide, that everybody, all the workers of the world, unite. And that struck fear into these capitalists. And so they turned against the communists, and they went into Germany, because Germany, obviously, was the one country in Europe that had a fighting chance of stopping the spread of communism. So they found a German army intelligence agent by the name of Adolf Hitler, and they funded him and helped him create national socialism, which in its socialist programs was essentially no different than communism, except it could be contained within national boundaries so that they could continue to play one country or one economic bloc off against the other to create the tension and conflict that resulted in not only control but huge profits for their corporations.
Let's spend some time this hour talking about Nazi technology, some of the weapons they developed, and some of the other systems they worked on. First of all, how did they get so advanced? How did they get so smart, Jim?
Well, that's a really, really good question. And, you know, George, as you probably have yourself, you've probably heard stories about that maybe back in the 20s or the early 30s that somehow the Nazis got hold of a UFO.
Yes,
and
I
they
heard that.
Back-engineered the technology. I've heard all those stories, but every time I tried to track them, I'd run into a dead end. What I explain in my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, is that what seems to have happened was is that going back to about the time of World War One, some of the more prominent and intellectual Germans, just like intellectuals in Britain and in the United States, were deep into spiritualism, and they were conducting seances, and they were practicing what we now call remote viewing, okay, which was then later, many years later, studied by the CIA and actually put into operation by the United States Army, starting about 1970 and lasting up until 1995, when they announced that they were discontinuing the program. But I don't think that was necessarily the whole truth. But these spiritualists who were having these seances, and they were remote viewing, or as some people call it, channeling. And it seems that they may have made contact with non-human intelligences. I point out and quote some knowledgeable people in my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, that said they actually had a unit within the German science community called Dr. Greenbaum, which means green tree, and apparently, this was allusion to the Garden of Eden and the Tree of Knowledge, and that within this unit, they had a group of psychics, spiritualists, seers, whatever you want to call them, and they operated under the name Magic, M-A-J-I-K, which ought to strike a note with you, George, because as we all know, the story is that at the top of the food chain in the UFO community mm-hmm. is this group called Magic 12 or MJ-12.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, did we bring some of those people over here after the war and roll them into our military-industrial complex, just like we did their rocket scientists and their mind control experts? It's interesting to ruminate about.
Yeah, with the Project Paperclip, I think.
Absolutely. And that was only one of several projects that were going on. In fact, it's been estimated that we probably brought over more than 100,000 Nazis in one way or another. Jeez. And rolled them in this country. But I want to be quick to point out, George, that I don't want anybody listening to get the idea that I'm saying that black-clad, goose-stepping German Nazis have taken over the United States. No, of course not. But we brought so many of them in here, and the people who were in charge of our giant corporations were quite comfortable with the National Socialist philosophy, and because it stimulated a blending of both state and corporate power. And if you'll go look in the dictionary, you'll find that the dictionary definition of this blending of state and corporate power is fascism. And, of course, the term fascism comes from Mussolini's black-shirted fascistis. But Mussolini, and I quote him in The Rise of the Fourth Reich, he himself said that fascism may not actually be the correct term. The more correct term is corporatism, ruled yeah. by the corporations.
And, you know, even if those Nazis appeared to switch allegiances because they lost the war, they got bought off. They lived well. I don't think any of the Nazis that were brought over to this country, Jim, lived as paupers, did they?
No, not at all. In fact, under Operation Paperclip, after a very short period of time, they were able to not only accumulate fairly decent salaries, certainly for the post-war America, but also bring their wives and their sweethearts and their mistresses all over at taxpayer expense.
And they stayed here until they all died.
And they stayed here, yes. And some of them aren't dead.
Well, they also infiltrated into the corporations in terms of purchasing some of them, didn't they? Didn't they have enough funding?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. In fact, one of the most fascinating segments of my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, is the very real possibility that in addition to the entire loot of Europe, they very well, according to some credible sources, actually discovered and acquired the fabled treasure of Solomon, the greatest treasure in the history of the world.
All that gold.
All that gold, silver, precious stone, and by the way, ancient scrolls and text and tablets, which again may have been one of the sources for their incredible technology. And the technology they had was just mind-blowing. I know I was so proud because back about the mid-50s, my dad actually bought a television set, and we became one of the first families on the block.
And guess where the TV information and knowledge came from? We'll be back in a moment. Jim Marrs, our guest, The Rise of the Fourth Reich on Coast to Coast AM. And we're talking with Jim Marrs about secret societies. As a matter of fact, it's a little like this.
May I have the password, please?
Fidelio.
That's right, sir. That is the password for admittance.
Sort of like Eyes Wide Shut, isn't it? We'll be back in a moment with Jim Marrs on Coast to Coast AM. Back to the technology for a while here, Jim. Some of the modern weapons that we're using today, they were working on then. A quick question about the atomic bomb. How did we beat them?
Well, you'll find out that there is an argument that we didn't beat them, that the Nazis indeed developed an atomic bomb. The problem was, by the time they had one ready to go, it was the spring of 1945, and the Russians were closing in from the east, and the Allies were closing in from the west, and the big problem they had was they did not have a reliable delivery system. They had 40 huge bombers, six-engine bombers, at a base in Norway described by Allied officers as one of the largest Luftwaffe bases they ever found. And the German crews up there said that they were being held in preparation for a strike on New York. I also have seen the 1943 Luftwaffe command study of an atomic bomb blast radius on the island of Manhattan. They were developing a three-stage rocket that they called the New York rocket, but they were not reliable. And there was another problem. At that stage of the war, if they had unleashed an atomic bomb on London or New York, would that have ended the war? No. What that would have done was to assure the literal elimination of Germany. We would have left no stone unturned. So apparently what happened was, at the highest levels, at the level of the ruling elite, a deal was cut, and they swapped their tremendous technology for immunity. 6 days after the war ended, the U-234 surfaced in the Atlantic and was taken into captivity by the USS Sutton. And on board were 50 gold-lined drums of uranium, along with Dr. Heinz Schlichter and his proximity fuses, the very things that we needed to make an atomic bomb work, because in early 1945, President Roosevelt was notified that using the centrifuge technique, we had only been able to enrich enough uranium to set off one plutonium bomb. And, of course, they had to test it, which they did at the Trinity site. But then, less than 2 months later, we had two uranium bombs to drop on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so where did they come from?
Fascinating. The fact that we would be working so closely to what they were working on, or vice versa, what does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that all of the top scientists on all sides were rushing to see who could develop a nuclear weapon first.
Were they sharing information?
Well, you have to understand that a lot of the people that were working on that were refugees from Germany. So there had to be some contacts, some family relations. But the main thing is the people who were funding Hitler were the same people on Wall Street and in England's Bank of England that were privy to these technological secrets.
A couple weeks ago, we had Linda Moulton Howe on for her regular appearance. And she played some snippets of an interview that she had done with you and talked a lot about the Nazi bell. Let's take just a few moments, Jim, and do that as well. What was that project?
Well, this was Die Glocke, or the bell. And they simply called it the bell because it was kind of bell-shaped. It was a large conical-shaped device. And what it was it had counter-rotating magnetic fields that apparently generated some sort of energy field within it. Apparently, they had several lethal accidents with the scientists that were working on it, and there was also other odd effects on nearby plants and animals. And apparently, it was this sort of energy manipulation that may lie behind the infamous Philadelphia experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, we were kind of messing with the same things. But the Nazis apparently made it work. Now, the problem was they killed everybody that had anything to do with this project, and it totally went dark at the end of the war and totally disappeared, along with the SS general Hans Kammler, who was in charge of that, as well as the rocket program and a lot of their more advanced technology. And, of course, the question would be, what happened to him and what happened to the technology? And there seems to be two schools of thought. One is that he came to America and, again, swapped this technology for immunity, which was, by the way, something he had already told Wernher von Braun, that he was going to swap the Americans the V-2 rocket technology and the rocket scientists in exchange for immunity. But then he told Wernher von Braun that he was going to disappear, and sure enough, he was never heard from again. And yet we know that it was Patton's army that scooped up the V-2 rocket scientist. So apparently he had something else that was even more exotic and more desirable than the V-2 rocket program.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the Bell was manipulating energy at the atomic and subatomic level, which is really gets spooky because now we're almost into UFO-type technology.
Exactly.
And it is absolutely historic fact that the Nazis had flying saucers on the drawing board. The only argument is did they ever actually build one and test one that could work? And the evidence is scanty, but it seems to be, yes, they did. And so I happen to think, and many other people do too, that some of the more early reports on flying saucers may have actually been Nazi craft.
Do you think the Roswell crash of 47 might have been our technology built by the Project Paperclip Germans of a saucer, but it was ours? Is that possible?
I would say that's possible, but I, for one, because as you well know, George, my book Alien Agenda has become the top-selling nonfiction book on UFOs
yes,
in the world.
Absolutely.
It's been translated into a dozen languages, and there is just too much overriding evidence to show that all of the reports of UFOs are not show that there's a technology at play there that is not man-made. So while it's possible, I think that the stories and the evidence and the narratives that have all come out of Roswell indicate that that was something other than man-made technology.
Okay.
But then we have other instances. For example, the UFO crash at Kecksburg, which you're probably familiar with.
Yep, sure am.
And they said it was shaped like an acorn. Well, oops. Sounds
like a bell, doesn't it?
Sounds like a bell. So, and here's the other spooky thing, too. We all know that when the UFO comes over, the car stops, and the UFO flies off, and the car starts again. And yet, if you go study the narratives, you'll find nobody ever says they turned on the key or they stepped on the starter and the thing started up. No. What happens is when that energy field comes over that apparently is canceling out gravity, and the scientists are beginning to realize that there is an integral relationship between gravity and time. So what happens is when the energy field from the UFO comes over, those pistons freeze and they lock up. Time stops. And this accounts for the missing time syndrome that is prevalent in all the UFO literature. A person says, well, I saw a UFO about 6 o'clock. And then I finally got home at 7 o'clock, but it was only a 10-minute drive. You know, I can't account for the missing time. Well, missing time was because when they were in the energy field, for them, time stopped. And if that's the case, then we can see that they were working with a technology that conceivably could manipulate time. Time traveling Nazis. Oh boy, it sounds like a bad 50s grade B sci-fi movie, doesn't it?
But real.
They were actually working on this stuff. And it all just disappeared, went quiet. Who got it? Well, the people who were funding and financing Hitler and the Third Reich. And we're talking about the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the Bank of England governors. We're talking about the Harrimans and the Bushes and the Walkers. And even Joseph P. Kennedy, was taken away as ambassador to England because he voiced pro-Nazi sentiments. That's the thing we have to understand, is that prior to World War II, before the war started and before the crimes of the Hitler became public knowledge, there were many, many prominent Americans and prominent corporations that were very pro-Nazi and that were actually instrumental in funding Hitler and the Nazis.
Well, that is so true. In St. Louis, I have a dear friend of mine. He's way up there in age, Whitney Harris, and he was one of the prosecutors at Nuremberg. And whatever happened to a lot of those Nazis who were convicted at Nuremberg?
Well, of course, they largely were all convicted, but interestingly enough, some of the more prominent scientists, the more prominent bankers and financiers, they either got off scot-free or were given very light sentences, like a few months in jail or something like that, and then they went right on and back into their
society
of endeavor. And then we had lots of Nazis who escaped through what they call the rat lines, many of them on documents and papers issued by the Vatican. And that sounds kind of odd, because you would think the Vatican would have been very anti-Nazi, and yet we find that there is still a continuing controversy over Pope Pius XII.
And his relationship with Hitler, right?
And his relationship with Hitler and the concordant that was signed between Hitler and the Church. And of course, now today we have Pope Benedict XVI, whose name is Joseph Ratzinger, who, as a youth in Poland, was a member of the Hitler Youth. So it's like, whoa, did we ever get away from him?
Oh, that's so true. That is so true. Simon Wiesenthal, who has passed away, died several years ago, was a Nazi hunter. He found a lot of Nazis who were hiding, escaped. But I got to believe that those Nazis were helped, Jim. Somebody helped them get away.
They were helped all along the way. They were helped by the old OSS, one of their chief officers in Switzerland was Alan Dulles, who then took over as OSS in Berlin at the end of the war, and, of course, then became the head of the CIA under Eisenhower, while his brother, John Foster Dulles, was Secretary of State under Eisenhower. And both of the Dulles brothers were attorneys for Sullivan and Cromwell, which represented the Nazi Schroeder Bank. And, in fact, they were quite prevalent in Germany prior to the war. And, of course, the mentor of Alan Dulles was John J. McCloy, the longtime head of National City Bank, which is now Citicorp. And McCloy was so close to Hitler, he actually sat with Hitler in his box during the 1936 Olympics. So we find these very prominent Americans and very prominent American corporations, such as IBM and Standard Oil, and J.P. Morgan, Brown Brothers Harriman, GAF, ITT, Ford, General Motors. General Motors had a plant in Germany, and when the war started, just like the plants over in our country when we went to war, that General Motors plant began to crank out war materials for the Nazi war machine. For a long time, it went unscathed, but then finally, towards the end of the war, apparently somebody said, well, that's, you know, we got to stop their war production. So they actually bombed the General Motors plant. And after the war, General Motors sued the United States government and said, you destroyed our plant and we want reparations. And American tax money was used to repay General Motors plant.
What about the pharmaceutical companies, the ones in Germany specifically, that are still existing?
Oh, yes. That was the bedrock of the Nazi empire, was the IG Farben chemical combine, which was the largest chemical company in the whole world. And they had already moved into drugs, and through licenses and subsidiaries, cross membership on boards of directors, et cetera, were just inextricably linked to United States business. Herman Schmitz, who was the head of IG Farben at one time, was said to have owned as much stock in Standard Oil as the Rockefellers. And so, again, at this level, we find that business was king. They didn't care about ideology. It was Standard Oil chairman who provided the special type of aviation gasoline to both Nazi Germany and to Japan that allowed them to carry out their bombing raids on Pearl Harbor and on bombing of London. It's amazing. You know, business is business.
Next hour, we'll talk about how the Third Reich is becoming the Fourth Reich, possibly here. You mentioned something in the book, and I'm doing a major show on that in a month or two, called What is Aspartame Doing to Us?
And killing us is what it's doing.
And how we got it approved in this country is unbelievable. But wasn't that developed during Nazi era time?
Yes, it was. In fact, most of the drugs that are on the market today, at one time, the German IG Farben was marketing heroin as a pain reliever under the name heroin. And, of course, we all know about aspirin, Bayer aspirin.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that they had all of this. But I think the one that really bothers me the most is sodium fluoride, which is a waste product of the aluminum manufacturing industry.
It's poison.
It's poison. Yeah. It was the only use prior to World War II was as a rat poison. And yet, the Nazis, and then later on the Soviets in their gulag, they would put sodium fluoride in the concentration camp water so to keep the inmates passive and non-resistant. And today, two-thirds of the water supply in the United States is being fluoridated.
Unbelievable.
It is. It's amazing. And there's still a huge controversy. And, of course, you know, anyone who's lived as long as I have can remember when we saw Lucille Ball and Humphrey Bogart on television saying, smoke Camels, they're good for you.
Yeah. Well, I used to remember in school, elementary school, getting pulled out of class because my parents had signed me up for these fluoride treatments. And, you know, I'd get in line with a number of other kids, and there'd be some dentist in there, you know, squirting fluoride on all of us.
Holy cow.
On our teeth.
Now, if you look on the fluoride toothpaste, it'll say, don't give it to children under age six or something like that.
Absolutely.
Because it's a poison. It's a poison. And I'm just thinking, why in the hell do we want to take poison?
I got it all. I got the injections that were bad, and God knows I'm still around, Jim.
Well, you're lucky you're still walking around.
So far, knock on wood.
Don't know what in long-term effects that is doing to our immunization systems, but we do know that we seem to be getting sicker and sicker as a nation. The incidence of cancer is just skyrocketing and many other debilitating diseases.
Do you believe Hitler killed himself?
I say there's a slim possibility that that's true. The problem is we don't know for absolutely certain. But you know what it boils down to is the only thing that we really know about the end of Hitler is what the Russians were told, and we were told by the Russians, and they got it from some of his closest
friends and supporters.
His supporters, you know, like his driver and his valet. And there's only one person in the whole world, his driver, Linga, you know, said that he heard a shot and that they had been ordered to wait 10 minutes after hearing a shot before they did anything. And so they waited. And then the next thing you know, the door to Hitler's apartments opened. And Martin Bormann emerged with a figure wrapped in a blanket. And then they came out carrying a woman. She was wrapped in a blanket. They took them upstairs, burned the bodies. The bodies were never found. They said they were all destroyed thanks to the Russian shelling. And then later the Russians came up, though, with a corpse and said, this is Hitler, although this corpse only had one testicle, which started the whole song about, you know, Hitler has only got one. You know, you heard it.
Let's talk a little bit. Hold on, Jim. Let's come right back. We'll talk about Hitler, and also then we'll talk about what might be happening here.